This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the BristolCon Fringe reading series.
And hello everybody, and welcome to another BristolCon Fringe reading. I trust you've all survived BristolCon and World Fantasy, for those of you who went down there. You're all here, which is a good sign. Our readers tonight are going to be Jonathan L. Howard and Ian Milstead. Jonathan will be with us in a little while. There'll be a break for filling your glasses and ordering food and whatever between the two readers. We have the usual table of books and things available, and you can buy your memberships for BristolCon 2014. Ian has kindly agreed to kick off, so I will hand straight over to him.
Thank you. My usual reading audience is reading Gruffalo to my 5-year-old daughter, so this is a bit of a change. But the story is The Traveller's Apprentice, which is from the forthcoming Airship Shape and Bristol Fashion anthology. The rusty digging tool hit something metallic. Vic's first reaction was to look round and see if any of the other dust searchers had heard the telltale sound. Safe, she thought. Most were some way off, and none had turned around to look at her. She turned her attention to carefully scraping around the sides of the object while keeping up a regular vigil for anyone drifting up close to her. Any find was rare enough, and there was, Vic had found the hard way over the last couple of years, no honour among her fellow scavengers. Twice she accidentally struck her find, but the clash of metal on metal was too quiet, dulled by the thick layer of mud and rust on both tool and object, for anyone to hear. The work was slow and methodical. Too slow, really. Anyone paying attention to her would quickly realise that she was only staying in one place for so long because she had found something. Finally, however, she managed to prise out her find. But she took care to keep it in the hole in the mud while she tried to examine it. Using her fingers to scrape off as much muck as she could, she saw that it was a tin of some quality. That was a find in itself, but what she saw when she lifted the lid caused her to take a sharp intake of breath. Living as a scavenger meant little real choice in what she wore. It was all found somewhere in the bags thrown out by the gentry and wealthy merchants of Bristol. However, as much as possible, Vic sought out close-fitting underwear and baggy top clothes, partly to disguise her gender as much as possible, should any down-on-their-luck dockers decide to save themselves the price of even a cheap whore, by taking advantage of those that might look unable to fight them off, and partly because the loose layers of coat and cloak gave more space to hide anything she might come across in her day's work, until she could get it to somebody who would give her a price that, while not fair, it was never fair for a dust searcher, was at least enough to pay for the next round of meals. Vic tucked the tin and another object she found below it into an inner pocket which hung close to her armpit, and when she was standing naturally, she moved to another spot in the mud and continued searching. To leave before the light started to fade would advertise all too obviously that she had found that she had struck lucky, and anyone bigger than her, which was most of them, would be on her before she reached the road. She also needed to find some more ordinary finds to pass off to anyone who did choose to get inquisitive anyway. The airship bucked in the wind slightly as Mr. William Freeze Green instructed his assistant to hold the camera steady. Green cursed audibly as he and his assistant both struggled to hold the heavy camera in place, a task not helped by the necessity of having to have the camera fixed at the correct angle to be ready to capture the action they are expecting to unfold below them at the county cricket ground. Once the camera was fixed in place, Green left his assistant to attend to the task of checking the lens, while he turned to face his business partner. All set in now, with the three cameras down at ground level, we are fully equipped and prepared to capture all the action leading up to what we hope will be Dr. Grace's 100th 100. Astonishing. I wonder if any other cricketer will ever match this feat. With all we've achieved, we're still ready to be impressed by a man hitting a ball with a stick, Mr. Adamson replied. Your invention of moving film is popular around the globe. I helped you add sound to the pictures, and now we're on the verge of sending our pictures directly into people's homes. We, my friend William, are truly ahead of our time, while W.G. Grace is in the Indian summer of his career. You have no romance in you, Adams, and days like this do not happen very often. But they will in the future, even if we have to arrange it ourselves. You may not follow sport, but I take pleasure from the sales of our films of such events. I believe people will pay us well for being able to bring them images of events and people they would not otherwise see. You've been correct before whenever I doubted you, said Freeze Green. I don't know how you do it, but I'm not going to bet against you being right this time. Adam said nothing in reply, but waved his arm over the crowd that was gathering to watch the day's play between Gloucestershire and Somerset. Green nodded in acknowledgement. Their cinematic theatres were doing good business with good audiences and new openings in cities on an almost weekly basis. The people liked what they were doing. Enjoy the game, Adamson spoke to break the silence. I have a feeling that Dr. Grace may have a successful day. Green watched as his business partner walked towards the lounge area where potential investors waited to be impressed by the new ideas with which the Adamson and Green Company is now associated. Adamson called to his driver to stop and let him out while he took a short, still a short way from his Clifton house. Sending the driver on ahead, he stopped to look up the electric streetlight. Somewhere across the Atlantic Ocean, a man called Thomas Edison was probably wondering why he kept finding that every time he tried to lodge a patent, he found that Adamson and Green had beaten him to it. Adamson mused on this thought that he was probably one of the few in Britain that even knew of Edison's existence. His thoughts were interrupted by approaching footsteps. They brought the person that Adamson was expecting. You have the money? Adamson asked the new arrival. Another win for you. Remarkable track record you have, Mr. Adamson. And are you increasing your own wealth by shadowing my bets? Just the old shedding here and there, sir. Well, good luck to you. Adamson walked away without adding further to the conversation. It was probably time to find another winning front for his gambling hobby. Either that, or he'd have to deliberately place a wrong bet to throw his man off from getting too suspicious. He walked the two streets to his townhouse to find a bundle of old clothes strewn on the steps. Pressing his foot against the pile, ready to push it out of the way, he heard a small cry. Be off with you, Adam said as the figure started to emerge from the old clothes. I don't give to beggars with the temerity to obstruct my front door. You'd have been better off trying the back earlier. The cook or housekeeper might have taken pity on you, but they're not thanking you for disturbing them at this hour. I have something for you, Mr. Adamson. Oh, I'm sure you do. Adamson put his key to the lock of the door. Are you male or female? It's hard to tell from either your voice or appearance. Not that it matters greatly, but it may make a difference when I come to advise my footman how much force he should use if he needs to throw you down these steps. I'm a girl, Mr. Adamson. I would strongly suggest you find a more suitable lodging for the night. I came to give you this. Vic held up a cigarette case, its golden colour still evident despite the dirt that clung to it in places. It has your name on it, Mr. Adamson, so I thought I should bring it to you. Adamson reached out and took it from the girl. With his gloved fingers, he tried to rub more dirt from the sides, but had little success. He could indeed read his name quite clearly. With his other hand, he patted the outside of his breast pocket of his jacket. Interesting. Why did you bring this to me? You do realise this is gold. You could have sold it for far more than any reward I'm likely to give you. You're not that mythological being, an honest thief, are you? I don't want any money for it, sir. Adamson turned the key in the lock and pushed the door open. He could see his butler lurking inside, ready to make himself obsequious when required. Well, come in then, and we'll see if we can't get someone to bring some bread and soup for you. But don't touch anything. I couldn't take anything. Good Lord, I never thought you would, since you've willingly brought me something of such value. I only meant anything you touched would have to be cleaned afterwards, given the state of you. Vic followed Adamson into the house. The butler emerged into the light of the hallway, and Adamson instructed him to feed the wretch, and then bring it back up to his study. He also instructed him to bring a chair from the kitchen for the wretch, to sit on when she was brought to him. Once they were both gone from the room, Adamson reached into his inside jacket pocket and brought forth a small gold cigarette case, identical in every way, bar the him. A rare expression of self-doubt formed on his face. So if you don't want a reward, what do you want? Dick looked across the room at this man who lived in a large house, smoked cigarettes out of a gold case, and was responsible for more innovations and new inventions than anyone else alive. He was, she was sure, no better than she. I want a job, Vic replied. I want to learn from you. Adamson seemed amused by the notion. Well, I applaud your initiative and ambition. It's more than half the men on my company board show most of the time. Where did you learn to read, by the way? I was at the Miller Orphanage before it was closed down, Vic replied. They taught us all the basics, but they told me I was better than most. They gave me a Bible of my own to read whenever I wanted to, and a copy of Jane Eyre as well. Yes, a pity about the orphanages, but it really was the best site for my studios to be set up. Plenty of sunlight. Do you still have your Bible? I had to sell it to buy food. Adamson sips the brandy while looking at the girl in front of him, effectively seeing her for the first time. Well, I like to play long odds sometimes, so I think I may take a chance. But, he warned, if this is some clumsy attempt to attach yourself to me in a way that might be considered incriminating for me, then I can assure you that my taste runs to women rather than girls. Adamson drained the brandy glass and rose to his feet. On the assumption that you do not have a home to go to, I'll have someone arrange a place for you to sleep in the kitchen for tonight. And in the morning, we will see to it that you are washed, dressed decently, and found suitable lodgings. Vic became, again, Victoria, a name she had not been known by since the orphanage closed down. Adamson arranged for her to lodge with the widow of a schoolmaster near Clifton College. From there, she walked each morning to Ashley Down, for so long her only home, where Adamson arranged for her to start work in the accounts and bookkeeping section of the film studios. Learn how this business works, he had told her, and see if you can't spot where our distributors are cheating us, for I'm sure they are. Vic's sudden appearance in the hitherto all-male office caused the expected ripples of gossip and disapproval. She had expected it, but compared to the sense of threat she had known each night sleeping on the streets, it caused her little concern. Adamson clearly enjoyed using her as a tool to stir up some of his managers. He had also instructed her with one additional task. She was to report to him in person once a week at his home with her own observations on how the business is working. Vic duly reported on which staff started early or finished late, which people were of little use after visiting the public house on Friday lunchtime, and which staff believed Mr. Anderson and Mr. Freeze Green could do no wrong. She was surprised, albeit not unpleasantly, so, to find that he took no action against those on whom she reported negatively. She had sensed that only true reports would satisfy Mr. Adamson, and had not wasted her time making safe reports, but nor had she wanted to see anybody out of work. Having known poverty, she did not wish it on anybody. The business of keeping track of numbers she entered in the large leisure volumes was no difficulty. She found she could see the patterns emerging, and the more she worked, the more it all made sense to her. After 2 months, she was ready to make a more telling report to Adamson. Your distributors in the Northwest are holding back about half of what they owe you. She showed Anderson the figures she had written down while everyone else had been at lunch. He perused them carefully. I believe you, he said. I'll look into it. Well done. It was a week later that Vic received a more unwelcome response to her work. Walking at a brisk pace from streetlight to streetlight through the autumnal dark, she became aware of footsteps behind her, but seeming to match her step for step. She increased her pace and, sure enough, a pursuer did likewise. Reaching the corner of Nugent Hill, she turned sharply. Her relief that the footsteps seemed to stop there was tempered by the voice she heard quite clearly. You think you're clever, don't you, Missy? Vic paused from her work to look up at the office calendar. The date that was fixed in her mind was tomorrow, possibly. If not, then another year at least. She returned to her bookkeeping task. She had, she believed, been followed twice more in the 3 weeks since the first unsettling incident. She had changed her route home several times, there being many alternative ways of walking through the city, but it did not seem to make a difference. The previous week, the man whoever he was, and followed her most of the way to Clifton. Vic thought she had managed to lose him near the end, but she was not absolutely certain. Perhaps he had been confused because that evening she'd headed to report to Mr. Adamson at his house, rather than going directly back to her lodgings. She hoped that she had not been seen going into the grand house for more reasons than one. 1 week on from the last incident, Vic was again due to see Mr. Adamson. She had worked quickly in order to leave at the same time as the girls from the canteen. They made it plain that they didn't approve of her, the slip of a girl taking on to work with the gentleman in the office. But she was not looking for approval or friendship. It was enough to know that none of the canteen girls was her stalker, and the facade of safety she felt, however thin, gave her a sense of confidence. After she parted ways with the last of her unknowing escort, somewhere in Redmond, she quickened her walking pace. She thought she was safely on her own and began to breathe easily despite the energy required by her stride pattern, when she caught a faint echo of a heavy boot on the stone pavement somewhere behind her. She glanced behind her briefly and saw a figure moving some way behind her, but definitely in the same direction. By the time she reached the end of the street where Adamson lived, the footsteps were audibly close. Vic tried to decide whether to keep her weekly appointment with her employer, balancing the relative safety of the big house against the longer-term jeopardy of letting someone hostile to her know that she reported there. The decision was made for her. "Going in to please your fancy gentleman friend again, are you?" The accent was not native to Bristol. Vic had never travelled beyond the city, but thought it sounded like that of the sailors who alighted at the harbour from boats out from Liverpool. She started to run for Adamson's house. "Of course, you're just a porter from the street anyway, aren't you? Don't know no better, some might say." "Should know better than start sticking your nose into other people's business, though." Vic saw the man start to run after her. He was heavy set, but made a steady pace. "Your fancy Mr. Adamson has enough money, doesn't he? Why should he keep it all to himself?" Vic finally reached the steps to Adamson's house and started to run up. She stretched her arm out to pull the bell lever that would summon the butler or footman, when she felt a sudden force impact into her back, forcing her to gasp for breath. Her shoulder struck the doorstep and she let out an involuntary scream. Rough hands pulled her up, turning around so that she was face up, and then pushed her back down to the floor. Pain lanced through her as her spine hit the smooth stone. In her peripheral vision, she saw that the door to the house had opened. She tried to crawl towards it, but the hands holding her stopped her making any progress. A well-polished shoe swung over her and struck her attacker in the face, feeling the hands release her as they instinctively meant to protect her attacker's face. Vic took advantage of the moment and scrambled for the doorway. She heard more sounds of violence behind her, but kept moving into the hallway until she heard a familiar voice. "I think you are safe now, Miss Victoria," said Mr. Adamson. Vic raised herself up to a kneeling position and tried to control her breathing. Slowly, her gasping breaths calmed, and she wiped the tears she became aware of sitting on her cheeks. The butler was pulling an unconscious man into the house. "What should I do with this, sir?" "Set him in the chair there, and be sure to send him on his way as soon as he is reasonably conscious." Adamson offered Vic a small quantity of brandy and a large glass. She sipped a tiny amount, enough to jolt her back to a state of alertness. "So, who is he? A secret admirer? Business contact from your former profession?" "Someone who's not too happy with me finding out that you're being cheated up north," said Vic. "At least, I think so. I've never seen his face before." Vic looked up at Adamson. He was smiling in a way that made her unsure if he was laughing at her or not. The butler had left her to get some ropes to secure her attacker in his chair. "I wonder," said Adamson. He rubbed his hand across his chin. Suddenly, he seemed to have made up his mind about something. "Come with me." Vic judged that his manner was such that he was not trying to lure her somewhere in order to take advantage of her vulnerability. He had not waited to see if she would follow. Following Adamson through a door, somewhat smaller and less ornate than the others, off the main hall, Vic found herself at the top of the staircase leading down to, she presumed, a basement. Electric lights hung at regular intervals around the twisting stairwell. At the bottom, there was one large room that must have stretched the whole length of the property. In the centre of the room was a large machine with a seat centrally positioned within. Adamson was standing by it, looking back at her, clearly a proud man. I used to have a business partner back in London before I met Mr. Freeze Green. He invented this machine, and I helped to supply the materials. He built two machines, one for each of us. He disappeared with his some time ago. This one is mine. I think you know what it is, don't you? You travel, Vic said slowly. In time, somehow. You travel back in time. Very good, although I use it to go forward in time. Better for business. The light bulbs, the films, everything you've done, they were all other people's ideas, weren't they? Well, you should give Mr. Freeze Green credit for the films. He really did invent that. I merely helped him make the money he surely deserved. As to the rest, well, perhaps you have been right somewhere, sometime, but those places no longer exist. Adamson walked around the machine, patting polished brass tubes and running his hand down mahogany panels. Vic edged forward to get a closer look. The machine was emitting a low hum, and she could see lights on in certain places. So, this is my secret, Adam said. Now, tell me yours. How did you really find my cigarette case? He pulled two cases from his pocket and held them up to the light. I only ever had one of these made and engraved. Now I have two. With his other hand, he pulled a pocket watch out and looked at the time. Vic closed her eyes. She'd expected this to go differently. Opening her eyes again, she caught a blur of movement on the stairs, in enough time to jump out of the way, as her attacker from earlier in the evening lunged at her again. Adamson moved forward, placing himself between the intruder and herself. Why was he not protecting his machine? Vic looked up to see the two men grappling hand to hand. The initiative seemed to be with the bigger, anonymous man, but Adamson was gradually turning him around to use the attacker's own momentum against him. The man kicked out at Adamson, but only achieved the result of losing his own balance and falling backwards into the time machine. Vic saw that he had a cigarette case gripped in one hand and a pocket watch in the other. The time machine gave out a screeching noise for a few seconds, and then both machine and intruder disappeared completely. Vic stood and stared at what she had seen. She wrapped her arms around herself, feeling a sudden chill in the room. From inside her clothing, she pulled out a gold pocket watch, identical in appearance to the one the intruder had taken with him. She turned to Adamson. I found these buried in the mud, Vic said as she offered the watch to her employer. Adamson took the watch and looked at it carefully. The face was cracked, and the time and date were fixed at the moment of breaking. The date was the very day, the time the very hour, the minute that he had seen on his own watch when they had been disturbed. Vic spoke again. I found them inside a skull. And you thought it was mine? Adamson looked philosophically at the place where the time machine had once stood. He shrugged his shoulders and smiled enigmatically at Vic. I think, he said, that we are going to see the age of Mr. Edison after all.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.